Good morning. My name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. This morning's guest on With Respect is Jessica Brockmole. Jessica is an author and has just published her first novel called Letters from Sky. It's a fascinating book. I've read it, and we're going to talk about not only her novel and herself, but talk about the intricacies of writing a novel like this. Jessica Brockmole, With Respect. Jessica, how are you this morning?
I'm great, John. Thank you for having me here.
You're quite welcome. You know, I read this book, and I told you before we start, I loved it. It's a great book for many different reasons, which we're going to talk about. I found some identification with this book. But the first question we've got to ask you, where are you from originally?
Well, I grew up in the Detroit area, and apart from a stint in Scotland, I sort of always lived here and there in the Midwest, So I'm a Midwestern girl at heart.
Whereabouts in the Detroit?
In Dearborn.
Okay, and that is a city just west. It's a suburb
just west
of Detroit.
That's right.
That has all kinds of interesting things, including the Ford Museum. The Ford Museum.
The Henry Ford Museum in Greenfield Village.
Greenfield Village.
Spent a lot of time there as a kid.
Did you really?
Oh yeah.
You know, when I was a kid, I was from Chicago, and I lived on the south side of Chicago, and as my listeners have heard before, I spent a lot of time, especially one summer, bicycling from my home to the Museum of Science and Industry, I love that. It's a magic moment. I love that museum, and every time I go back, it just kind of brings all kinds of memories back. It's really cool.
We're taking our kids to that museum for the first time in a couple weeks.
Are you really?
It's lovely. I'm looking forward to seeing that in their eyes.
Think about it as, here's a 10-year-old kid, me, bicycling in and spending the whole day just wandering around.
Oh, yeah.
And it's great. So you did that at Greenfield Village?
Yeah, my mom volunteered there at the museum and we spent a lot of time there. My parents loved it. I remember times even while my mom was working, I just sort of wander Greenfield Village by myself with a book, of course, finding little spots to sit and explore.
When my mother and her sister would be going down to Chicago to shop when I was a kid. Dad would be off working, and they would be, this is the big deal. This was a big deal. They wore white gloves, and they were all dressed up. And I had to be dressed up because we were going downtown, and this is important. But at any rate, what they would do with me, because they didn't want to drag me all around the place, was to stash me in the books section of Marshall Field's bookstore. And
perfect.
I would sit there, and I would read to my heart's content. And I think they probably slipped $5 to the lady who was on the desk to just, don't let him wander off too far. But anyway, so museums are a big part of my life, and it sounds like with you as well.
Mm-hmm.
I find them places of romance. I find them places of learning and time to be alone. It's neat.
Yeah, and that's sort of my approach to history, too, even when I do research now for my historical fiction is, you know, with a museum, there's so much there, but then there's also so much tucked in the corners. And just like with a history book, sometimes you find the most fascinating things in the footnotes. And so you spend enough time in a museum or a history book, not just sort of skimming through or browsing, but just really taking the time to explore the little things that most people don't notice. And those are the things that catch my interest the most.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me about your family, your parents. What did they do? Were they from Dearborn originally?
Yeah, both of them sort of grew up in the metro Detroit area. And I guess growing up in Dearborn, the question is always, so which parent works for Ford? That's sort of how it goes, and my dad does.
Yeah.
But my parents were always very much into history, living history, which is why we spent a lot of time not only at Greenfield Village, but at other sort of living history sites and museums throughout the U.S. I mean, we always do a lot of traveling. I saw more battlefields than most kids my age.
Which ones did you go to?
Civil War battlefields.
Gettysburg.
We did go to Gettysburg quite often, and a lot of them sort of blurred in my mind.
Yeah, the usual run around Washington, if you're going that way, is Gettysburg, Antietam, Fredericksburg, Chancellorsville, the Civil War battlefields, Bull Run outside of Washington.
Yeah.
Every time I went to my first visit to Gettysburg when I was about 11, and I remember it vividly for little things. But every time I go back there, which has been about four or five times since then, I take a different person, i.e., I'm different, with me.
That's right.
When I go. And so I see something different each time. One time I went there, they had a reenactment, 20,000 people reenacting a part of the Battle of Gettysburg. And the reenactors were absolutely fascinating, and the camps that that everybody lived in, and the cannons. And I think the most startling thing was when at the end, we were in the spectator section with my daughter, and she was sitting on my shoulders and to see over the crowd. And I remember a man riding along in a Union officer's cavalry officer's outfit, and he had his hat off and waved it to the crowd, and as he rode along, he said, "We hope that you've enjoyed and learned from today, and especially," and he's waving his hat around, "to appreciate what those who come before us have given us." And it just choked me up. It was so powerful. Anyway, history, that's your interest, right?
It is. And I think, you know, especially when I was really young and maybe we were at a battlefield that I didn't find as interesting as my dad did, you know, I'd sort of go into my head a little bit and I'd try to think, you know, if I were, you know, 150 years earlier or whatever in this spot, what would I be doing?
Mm-hmm.
What would a person like me be doing in that time, in this place?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe these were the... maybe these were the sort of states of mind that led to wanting to write historical fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was always sort of imagining and trying to take myself back into history and trying to, think about what it might be like to be in the head of somebody living in that place and time.
Did you, brothers, sisters?
I have a younger sister. Yeah.
What is she doing?
She writes? She doesn't. She's an occupational therapist.
Okay. So where did the writing come from in your history?
Well, I always loved writing. You talked about bicycling to the museum. I remember the day when I was allowed to bicycle by myself to the local library, which was sort of my refuge. This was my place.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a great big dollhouse right when you came in the front door, and they, you know, would change out the scenes based on the season.
Mm-hmm.
And the librarians all knew me. If something new came in that they thought that I would like, they would put it under the counter. They wouldn't put it on the shelves quite yet because they knew I'd be in the next day and they could pass it on to me. But I would ride up, you know, have my bike basket just full of books. I'd get a stack, read them all that day, you know, in the summer, of course, and then bring them all back the next morning. And it really seemed a possibility that I might read through all the books in the library. You know, especially when I was younger and I was in the, you know, middle grade section of books, and, you know, there's a limited number. It could happen. So I tried to write my own. I wanted to sort of fill in that space. There were some stories I just wanted to explore past what they said on the page.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the way a lot of people get into writing, I think even as adults, is wanting to explore the stories that they like a little more.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was always writing.
Now, I hope you didn't do what my brother did when he was young. He wanted to be a writer, mm-hmm. also. He and his friend across the street decided to publish a local newspaper for the block. And this was when he was about 7 years old. And the two of them, actually, they found out how to do print. And they went out and they did research. And unfortunately, they found out some secrets.
Uh-oh.
That shouldn't have been put into this newsletter. And so my mother had to shut it down.
Oh,
because
no.
The parents were coming in saying, you know, I really don't need who came late at night to be part of this story.
Oh, my goodness.
But anyway. But he went on from that,
uh-huh.
into a desire, and he carried it out to be, yeah. a journalist. He went to Northwestern and Medill and became a reporter and so on. So now he moved off. He finally succumbed to the family DNA failing, which is he became a lawyer like the rest of us. But before that, he almost escaped, you know. So now, what about the first, where'd you go to high school?
I went to Plymouth Salem High School in,
mm-hmm.
Canton.
Yeah, and then what did you do there that was of interest to you?
I definitely loved all of the sort of English classes and arts classes and writing classes that I took there. I remember doing an independent study on sort of Celtic literature and poetry and art, which I was really interested in at the time.
Cool.
And yeah, and I had planned, I had actually, you know, started collecting college applications for English programs, creative writing programs, because that was it. That's what I'd always had, I guess, in my plans. But then as I was doing this independent study, I sort of, I thought about studying English and studying literature, and I thought, well, you know, I like the writing part, the words. I don't know how much I want to read,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I was a big reader, but, you know, it's sort of different than studying literature.
Mm-hmm.
So I was doing this independent study, and I came across the word linguistics, which just sort of summed up for me the part that I loved about English, about writing. I liked, you know, feeling those words, and I liked using them and moving them and manipulating them. That's what I ended up going to study. I went and studied linguistics.
One of the great things about the English language is that, and especially American English, I know it happens elsewhere, but we are known for taking words, twisting them, turning nouns, mm-hmm. into verbs, verbs into adjectives,
yes.
and so on, and making a portmanteau words turn into words that we use on a regular basis, and we don't know why. But that's the manipulation of the language.
Oh, it is. It is. And knowing the words that you could use in a situation, the words that you might want to use, but they don't quite work. You know, I like that. And
mm-hmm.
I've always loved studying word history, you know, etymologies. Where did words come from and how did they change? What did a certain word mean at a certain point in history?
Mm-hmm.
And I was always very interested in that as I was sort of studying English and writing in high school. So it sort of seemed a natural area of study for me,
mm-hmm.
to go into.
So where did you go from high school?
I went to Oakland University
mm-hmm.
for a little while, and then to Michigan State.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I got my degree in linguistics.
In linguistics. I can't say it right now.
And then I went to graduate school at University of Illinois.
Oh, so that begins to lead inexorably into Letters from Sky.
Absolutely.
Ah, I see. Well, all right. At one point, you said that you went to Scotland. And how did that happen?
Well, after my husband and I were married and we met at the University of Illinois, he was offered a job in Edinburgh at the University of Edinburgh, mm-hmm. and our daughter was 2 years old then. It seemed as good a time in our life as any to take a leap like that and to sort of set off on a little adventure.
Mm-hmm.
So we did.
Edinburgh's a fantastic city.
Oh, it is.
I love it. I was there 1 year for the Edinburgh Festival. And
yes.
In fact, I think it was 2 days or 3 days. One was the last day in which they had Edinburgh Castle is on the Royal Mile, and mm-hmm. it sticks out on a sort of a little mountain in the middle of the city. And they had the Edinburgh Symphony Orchestra down in the pit where the trains come in. And then they had fireworks, and they played mm-hmm. music, and the fireworks all went off of the Royal Mile and Edinburgh Castle. Unbelievable, gorgeous, wonderful thing. At any rate, so I love the Edinburgh Festival, and we're going to come back more to talk about Scotland in just a minute, but we're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Jessica Brockmole, who is the author of a fascinating book called Letters from Sky, which we'll be talking a lot about as we move along. This is With Respect, and this is John Smetanka. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Jessica Brockmole, who is the author of the book, a first novel called Letters from Sky. Jessica, you got over to Scotland. Now, had you written anything for publication by that time?
No, I'd written plenty, especially after my daughter was born. I sort of was staying at home with her, and I went back to my first love, writing.
Mm-hmm.
I was sort of feeling my way through writing novels, but I hadn't finished anything yet.
Mm-hmm. I know the feeling. I've got two of them, 10 chapters each. I'm not going anywhere yet. But, all right, what about Scotland attracted you the most?
When we moved over there?
Yeah.
We had gone to visit before my husband was offered the job, and we were really attracted. We really felt at home with, I suppose, the way of life.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I mean, obviously Edinburgh is a, you know, it's a decent-sized city.
Mm-hmm.
And people from real cities laugh when I say the word city in conjunction with Edinburgh. But, you know, it was bigger than any place I'd ever lived. but I, you know, sort of the pace of life, everything is a little smaller and slower and quieter.
Mm-hmm.
And compared to the United States, mm-hmm. I think. And we really sort of, we liked that. And it's Edinburgh. It's an amazing city. It's hard to say no.
Yeah, it is. I've been to Edinburgh on a couple of occasions, and it just grabs you.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk about this in a minute, but I'm going to start off with some novels that I have read, which Ian Rankin wrote novels about detective stories,
mm-hmm.
Which are set in Edinburgh. But the same can be true of many other writers who tickle my fancy if they introduce me to a place which they can capture and convey to me the romance of it, or the intrigue, or even the scariness of it, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's an indefinable thing that they can give me. What about you? What would you, if you were going to describe Edinburgh through the eyes of Jessica Brockmole, and part of your book is set there.
It is.
And how would you describe this city, this wonderful place? What's unique about it?
Well, I mean, I suppose I approach the city as a woman who'd never lived outside of the Midwest, mm-hmm. who's always been very interested in history, and to be in a place that had so much more history than any place I'd lived before mm-hmm. was amazing. I mean, just to walk down a street and you see a little sign that Robert Burns lived in this house, and just for the record, in Scotland there are signs all over the place about Robert Burns, and he stopped here for a night, or he had a cup of tea here. But just to see that, just to be able to touch a wall and think about all the centuries of history in that wall right there, was what really entranced me about the city at first when I was there.
Now, I've got to ask you this, because no one who's been to Scotland could miss this. Did you like haggis?
I don't eat much meat, so I haven't tried it. I've tried vegetarian haggis, which is not the same thing, but that's good.
I don't mean to be camp about it, but haggis is an interesting form of meal that is unique to Scotland.
And, it is.
And it has questionable contents as far as, I'm a Mr. Midwestern guy too, and my stomach is not quite ready for haggis. All right. Where else did you go in Scotland?
We didn't have a car when we lived there. So periodically we would rent a car for a Sunday, and we'd drive out as far as we could go for the day to explore. So we sort of made it down to the borders, saw Sir Walter Scott's home. We'd rent it for a weekend. We'd drive up a little further into sort of the Speyside area. Made it up to Inverness. Sometimes what we do is we would go to the train station, and we had two little kids at the time. We'd go to the train station on a Sunday morning, and we would literally get on whatever the next train to leave the station was. Go to Waverley Station.
All right.
I mean, hey, if you're going to explore where you're at, it's the way to do it.
Yeah.
And so, we'd explore all of the, Glasgow and all the places not too far, an easy train ride outside of the city. And then one week after our very first festival season in Edinburgh, which you've been there, so
I've wonderful.
It's wonderful, but it's after a month, it's you want a little bit of an escape because it's a very crowded city.
That's right.
And so one fall, right after our first festival season, we rented a car for a week, and we went up to the Isle of Skye.
Now, many of our listeners know where Skye is, but many don't. So describe Skye, where it's located, and how you got there.
Well, Skye is an isle in the Inner Hebrides, so it's off the northwest coast of Scotland. And until fairly recently, it was only accessible by ferry. There's a bridge there now. But it used to be that you'd have to get there by ferry, as many of the islands kind of over there. And the island it's not very big. It's about, I'm going to get this wrong. It's not very big. It's about the size of a good-sized city, the island itself. But today there are only about 9,000 inhabitants. Until fairly recently, too, this probably coincided with the bridge, it wasn't really a getaway destination. It wasn't really a place where too many sightseers went, although it was always has been a very popular spot for mountain climbers and hikers. You have some great mountains there to climb.
And people who want to escape.
Exactly.
For example, from the Battle of Culloden.
Yes.
Who escaped out that away?
Bonnie Prince Charlie.
Bonnie Prince Charlie.
Yes, he did.
And he got in. He escaped and dressed as a woman, mm-hmm. right? And left at some point along the line. He left the formula for the old drink that his family had the secret recipe to.
Mm-hmm.
What was the name? What liqueur is that?
Drambuie.
Drambuie.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting too. When I was researching Letters from Sky, one book that I read, it was a, I'm trying to remember if it was a diary or letters written by the daughter of the family that, you know, sort of produced Drambuie.
Mm-hmm.
And she was attached to the Scottish Women's Hospital during World War I, and she went to Serbia. But it was sort of interesting to find that connection, because I didn't know about that until I read her diary much later after we had already visited Sky.
Mm-hmm. Now, in Sky, which is a mountainous island.
It is.
And it is 9,000, I think, is generous. At least when I was there, it was fewer than that. But there's Portree,
yes.
which is a little fishing village sort of down in the southeast part of the island. Correct me if I'm wrong. And then up north, as you go north along the coast, mm-hmm. you come to Uig.
Yes.
And Uig is a jumping off place for ferries out to the
yes.
Outer Hebrides. And but each of them are just like what you would imagine or have been shown in movies about the Scottish Highlands, i.e.
Yes.
Clustered village around a harbor,
mm-hmm.
Hills built along the side of the cliff, or the mountain, rather, and mountains, and just a very neat place, I think.
And it's, you know, and there's so many extremes on Skye, too. I mean, you have all the mountains, but those are more towards the south. And then as you sort of get, it's a little greener
mm-hmm.
once you start moving north, and it's... Yeah.
What's the spirit of Skye? You write about it in your book, and we're going to talk about this book as we go along, but what is the character that you are trying to capture with the island of Skye?
The one thing that really struck me about Skye, and so I while we were there, I gathered a lot of maps
mm-hmm.
wherever I could, and I'd sort of look over them each night, and you were talking about sort of the legends and the myths mm-hmm. and the history associated with the island, and I loved that I could see those right in the place names, you know, the name of this cove or this beach or that cave or that city, and you mm-hmm. can see the history right there. And being there, I really understood how, you know, until very recently, people truly did believe in sort of this supernatural there mm-hmm. about these ghostly pipers and the fairy folk and these water spirits. And I mean, they really and truly did believe in, you know, I could see that. And I mm-hmm. could see that not only in the map, but just in the landscape, and how if you're trying to find an explanation for why a certain part of the island feels the way it does, the way the wind feels, the way it sounds coming through the caves, I mean, how you would come up with those explanations
mm-hmm.
and how they would seem to be the ones for it.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of grabbing onto and testing the spirit of any place, but in Skye, with the mountains and, as you say, the coves
mm-hmm.
and the caves and the greenery, and one of your characters, I think, raised sheep or was around sheep herding,
yeah.
a lot of that.
There are always sheep there.
There's always sheep. In fact, all through the Highlands, I keep
yeah.
running into sheep, and I couldn't, oh.
Oh, and they just wander. They wander straight across the road.
That's right. And it's their road. It's not yours.
Oh, absolutely.
All right, so we're now to the point where I can see where Skye fits into your first novel.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And Edinburgh is in your novel.
Yes.
And Champaign, Urbana, Illinois,
exactly.
of all places. I couldn't figure out, whoa, where's the connection?
What's that connection?
Yeah. But in each of these areas, and London,
mm-hmm.
They contributed something, not only simply a place, but a spirit.
Yeah.
And they're all different. So let's tease it out. We've talked about Edinburgh. We've talked about Skye. What about London? Did you spend much time in London?
London was actually the only place that I hadn't visited until quite recently. So I hadn't been to London before writing that.
Mm-hmm.
But I needed what would be to me a more neutral spot for the characters, because London is sort of a turning point for both of them in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I needed a place just to serve more as a soundstage for that.
Okay. We'll get back to London in a minute, but let's shift back to your roots, which also plays a part in this book, which would be the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. So what about that? What is so unique about that for you?
Well, when I tried to think of what kind of character would sort of reach out to a stranger the way my main character David does, I tried to think of who that could be, and a Midwesterner seemed natural to me. A Midwesterner who
write about what you know.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You know, sort of the friendly Midwesterner reaching out, meeting people, not being afraid to say what they want to say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wanted to sort of embody that in a character. And you know, I wanted to pick a place that I knew. It also helped. They had a very good digital archive, which was helpful when I was in Scotland in accessing, you know, what sort of courses were available then and what sort of stories about student life were there. The character is he's a prankster. He really sort of throws himself into campus life. It's a lot of fun to write about.
We're going to leave Champaign-Urbana for just a minute. We're going to take a break. We're talking to Jessica Brockmole, the author of her first novel, Letters from Skye. This is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Jessica Brockmole, the author of Letters from Skye. This is John Smetanka. Now, Jessica, when we broke, you had basically done for us what you needed to do to set the places here.
Mm-hmm.
And to set the the places help to set who the characters are.
Yes.
And now, I am not a believer in spoilers, so therefore I don't expect you to reveal how the whole plot works out. But you can give us an outline, if you would, of what is this Letters from Skye? Tell us about it.
Well, I had wanted to write a story told in nothing but letters. This was something I'd had in the back of my mind. And after visiting Skye, I had the idea for a character who was a poet, who was very tied to this sort of this otherworldly mystery of the island. And I needed to find somebody to write to her. I needed to find a correspondent. So Letters from Skye begins when an American college student, he's a little bit of a prankster, he's a little bit of a risk taker, an adventurer, he very impulsively sends a letter to a fan letter, to a Scottish poet on the Isle of Skye, after having read one of her books of poetry, which he admits right from the beginning is not his usual fare. He's not usually a guy to read poetry. And she's obviously a little sheltered, having lived on Skye her whole life. She's never received a fan letter, which of course he doesn't know. And she is curious and responds, and sort of being unskilled in the art of replying to fan letters, I suppose, she reveals a little more of herself than she expected, which strikes up a friendship between them that eventually develops into something more, just as World War I is beginning.
The World Wars, one and two, and this, and you span both wars.
I do.
In this book. The World Wars one and two created whole new worlds in Scotland and London, in the UK, of course, in Europe, but it did in the United States as well. They were the changing points for massive changes, social changes.
Absolutely.
And how did you capture that, those changes, say with your first character, your male character, mm-hmm. David Cameron, how did you do that?
I tried to capture it a lot with David and with his family. You know, his father really sort of, to me, in many ways, represents the, you know, the Victorian gentleman, the Gilded Age gentleman, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wears a pocket watch, is afraid to drive a car, thinks that his son should really follow into his footsteps and become a physician. And, you know, David wants to go skiing and he wants a wristwatch. And he has very different ideals than his father, especially when the war begins and they start having discussions about whether or not the U.S. should enter the war. And I think this is something that I found interesting in my research is, you know, how divided a lot of Americans were. You had those who had really strong ideals and who ended up finding ways to involve themselves in the war.
Oh, that's in World War One.
World War One, yes.
Mm-hmm. What about on the other side of the Atlantic with your character Elspeth, the poet mm-hmm. from Skye? What about there? What about worlds there?
Well, I mean, Skye was a little different in World War One. I think in that, and the case was probably true with many of the other Hebridean islands, but on Skye in particular, I mean, they really felt isolated. They felt really distant from the war. Like, it wasn't really their fight. And, you know, the men would volunteer because that's, you know, because you did that. But that the war really wasn't going to touch them in any way. And I really got this impression from a lot of letters and diaries that I read.
Mm-hmm.
But then there was one battle in which many boys from Skye died all at once. And the tone sort of changed in the letters and diaries after that point.
How?
That we're not as far away as we think. That this war reaches out and it can touch us even as far north as we are.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of the attitude sort of started to change. What I don't know is I don't know if there was more volunteerism after that. I'm not sure about that. But the attitude was sort of turning in that direction, that we were affected by this war. And I think that carried through until the next war, too. In World War II, I know that a lot of children were evacuated up to Skye.
Mm-hmm.
So people there were taking a different role in involving themselves right from the beginning.
You know, it's interesting to me, that period of time from World War One to World War Two. I've been reading a lot about it lately, and there was the creation of mystical worlds of the world is going to be a better place. It's going to be wonderful.
Oh yes,
and people would not let go of that. And on both sides of the Atlantic for mm-hmm. different reasons.
Yes.
And I read one book recently on the American fight within us, within our country, over getting involved in European conflicts again, that is World War
uh-huh.
II.
Okay.
And then those people who believe that it was necessary, you know, neither yes we do or no we don't, and they had huge fights. And surprising separations of the house, the intellectuals, the labor, the business, the writer and political classes all had strange bedfellows with one another on both sides. I just finished a book talking about the exact same thing in England. during that same period of time, from the late 20s on into the to the time of the Second War, the beginning of the Second World War. Again, there was the anti-appeasement group and the appeasement group, and the it seemed that the people who were anti getting involved in a war in both places were hanging on to this sort of Wilsonian, oh, the world's going to be better. We can have the League of Nations. We're gonna it's going to be perfect if we can just all get along, and then catastrophes, just huge, massive catastrophes and disruptions by the war. And it brings it right into your, among your characters, there's that same intervention of miserable war changing people's lives. So what did you do to grasp onto that?
It's an interesting question. I, you know, some part of it was trying to, well, obviously reading a lot of, like you were saying, I mean, I don't know that I've read those particular books, but reading books that sort of explore these different factions of people who thought they should get involved or they shouldn't on both sides of the Atlantic. And then trying to put myself in that situation, which was very, very difficult, obviously. And I tried to sort of represent this difference in my characters. I mean, Elspeth is in the UK, where it technically was their fight at that point in the war, which she doesn't see and she doesn't agree with. And then before the United States entered the war, you have David in the United States thinking that it is his fight, that he does have a stake in it. And he tries to go off and see what he can do to, what he can do to lend a hand. And he joins the American Field Service, volunteering to drive ambulances for the French Army.
This is a very tender part of your story. The relationship built up between Elspeth and David goes through cycles, and it's interesting how their letters bring out the cyclical nature of that relationship, up, down, in, out. Mm-hmm. You also use something which I find intriguing. You're not the only author who's done it, but you do it well, which is the interplay of times, back and forth from the past to the middle to the present and so on, back and forth and in and out. How did you keep track of all of that?
Well, when I wrote the first draft of Letters from Skye, I wrote Elspeth and David's story, their letters, from when he first sends that fan letter in 1912 until sort of the middle of World War I. And as I read through that first draft, I realized that there were pieces of their story missing. I mean, I knew I wanted it to be their story, but they couldn't tell everything, especially since I was limiting myself to telling it only through letters. They couldn't reveal everything. There were some things they didn't know. There were some things they wouldn't write to one another. And I felt I wanted to bring in another character. But I also wanted to reveal sort of what happened after their letters ended. So I brought in the character of Elspeth's daughter, Margaret, who, as we see near the beginning of the book, is living in Edinburgh, sort of near the very beginning of World War II. And she has a best friend who's a pilot in the Royal Air Force, and she's writing letters to him. And I use their letters and also bringing in some other characters into that storyline to fill in the blanks, to tell the other sides of Elspeth and David's story that they can't tell. And I use it as a complimentary story, too, because Margaret has her own correspondence. She has her own boy that she's writing to who's off in dangerous places. And I use her letters also to bring in Elspeth's reactions, you know, years and years later, remembering when she waited for letters from a man off on the front. And so I sort of weave in those stories throughout the whole book.
Did you, just on a technological standpoint, did you find it difficult to keep track of what you were doing? Because the reader has to do a serious checklist when they go from letter to letter.
Mm-hmm.
So it's from character to character, time to time. And I would imagine that putting together would have been ticklish also.
It wasn't too bad because I wrote, you know, sort of the main story, the mm-hmm. World War I story first. That was already set. And then it was just sort of weaving in and finding where the holes were and where I needed to fill them in. And actually, some of the characters that you meet in the World War II storyline, some of the correspondents, didn't really appear until the very last draft, actually,
mm-hmm.
when I realized, you know, I needed just one more perspective. And that, that filled it in. So Elspeth's brother comes in as a correspondent. Yeah. And he, I can't imagine the story without him, but he was mm-hmm. a very recent addition.
Absolutely fascinating. I am not I'm not into what they call chick lit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more of a Tom Clancy or a history devotee or science fiction or something. I found this to be something more, and that's what I want to say. We're going to take a break, and I want you to come when we come back. I want to talk to you a bit about this concept, which is tossed out there of chick lit, and what you were writing, which is different. We'll be talking with you about that in a minute. This is John Smetanka. We're on With Respect with Jessica Brockmole, who is the author of Letters from Sky. We'll be right back. We're now back with Jessica Brockmole, who is the author of a first novel, Letters from Sky. And this is John Smetanka, and the program is With Respect. Jessica, I teased it up for you, set it up for you. and the reason I did is because I picked this book up primarily because of Sky.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything else flowed into it. And I won't even get into the personal reasons why all of this was very meaningful to me, except one point we're going to raise in a minute, but the genre that you're writing,
mm-hmm.
this is not exactly aimed only at women, is it?
No, and the idea of genre is interesting in that I never really considered it until I sold the book to Ballantine. To me, I was writing historical fiction.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I always labeled it. It was set in the past. Obviously, it was historical fiction. And I volunteer with the Historical Novel Society for their publication, the Historical Novels Review. I write reviews, and I'm a reviews editor. So to me, it's set in the past. It involved a lot of research, historical fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised after selling it to Ballantine to learn about all of the other genres that it could fall under.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed this too in reviews, seeing where people are sort of classifying it in their mind. I've had a lot of people refer to it as women's fiction. A lot of people refer to it as historical romance. I mean, things that never would have come to my mind as I was writing it. But I think when people are thinking about the genre they like to read, you know, they'll see if they can classify it in there, if it sort mm-hmm. of fits their personal definition.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that genre is often a, you know, it's a marketing definition.
Well, and that, mm-hmm. and here the reason I raise it is mm-hmm. very specific. I think that by targeting, by putting these labels on things,
yes,
we can tend to detract from the market itself, mm-hmm. the value of the book. I remember I read a book called Possession by
yes.
A.J. Byatt.
Byatt, yeah.
And loved it. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a romance, for pity's sakes, mm-hmm. but it's wonderful. It's a great book.
Oh, it is.
And so it appealed to me as much as Tom Clancy and the history books that I read. Now, what were you trying to tease out here about human nature. That is something that every book that has any value, it seems to me, gets a hold of a thread, and it just pulls mm-hmm. it out. A beautiful sweater or something like that, you find a loose thread and you
That's
pull
right.
it out. What were you pulling out here?
One of my big themes, I think, in the novel is fear. Both characters have their own fears. Even David, who is such a risk taker that he thinks he has none, mm-hmm. he discovers once he is in the thick of things, once he's volunteering, that he's sort of left a part of himself open through those letters to Elspeth. And she has very specific fears. We learn early on in the book that she's afraid of water and she's never left the island, even though she sort of always keeps her eyes fixed towards the mainland, thinking about what else is out there in the world.
And a real genuine fear of water.
It is.
It's not just, and even we know that the distance between Skye and the main part of Scotland is very short.
Oh,
very
it
small.
Is. There's a bridge now.
Now, yeah.
So it's not that far away.
So fear is one.
Mm-hmm. What,
now, I'm going to tell you a story. I will. Mm-hmm. After my mother died, my father lived with me for several years before he passed away. During that time, and they were married for 60 years and had, you know, great relationship. But during his last years, he came up with, he said, you know how to do this computer thing, don't you? And I said, yeah, I do. And he said, here, I want you to find whatever happened to so-and-so. And I said, okay, who is so-and-so? Oh, it's a woman I knew many, many years ago. He was tracing back, and he was. This is not a person who was slipping off into some sort of delusional world. This was something very important to him. He was very alert to the moment he died, mm-hmm. and with it. But this was important to him is to tie together a loose end
yes.
in a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you write about.
And that's another theme, too. Another theme is, especially with Margaret, is family history, too. It's Elspeth is fond of saying to her daughter that the first volume of my life is out of print. I mean, it's mine. It's gone. It's past. She's focusing on the second volume. She's focusing on her life with her daughter. And that's something that Margaret's happy with. But when she discovers Elspeth's letters and begins to sort of piece together this past, of course, she's curious. Mm-hmm. She wants to know about the family that she never knew. She wants to know about her mother's own connection with that earlier war, what brought her to Edinburgh. And I think that's sort of a theme that we can all relate to is wondering about our own families and, sort of the difficulty, too, in imagining our parents going through the same things that we go through at times
mm-hmm.
and not realizing that, of course, they can relate in many ways.
Well, I tortured my daughter as she was growing up by forcing her to listen as we rode around in the car together to various kinds of things which I wanted to expose her to,
mm-hmm.
and also I like them. And one of the things I enjoyed listening to was music out of the 40s.
Uh-huh.
Why? Because I was doing the same thing that you were doing
yeah.
as you touched Edinburgh walls.
Yeah.
I was saying, this is what was popular with my parents when they were my age. How did that touch them? How did they create this world? And I remember as one of the, again, one of those experiences that you don't forget. I was in New Zealand and went to a small town that was opening a museum for the Royal New Zealand Air Force during the Second World War. And they had reconstructed various buildings that would bring the viewer into what it was like, when they were, the engines were revving up
oh, yeah.
and the pilots were getting ready, they're getting their briefing and they're going out to and I thought, and this music was interwoven in the back It's a long way to Tipperary, and the White Cliffs of Dover, and Lily Mar Lane, and the music was, and it all created this image. And I kept thinking, what was my dad thinking when he was in Germany, when he was in Scotland, just getting ready to go over to Europe in the war. And I find it absolutely stunningly interesting and a very evocative. And that's what part of the thing I liked about your book is that it allowed me to do that, to put myself back in their ages. And I transposed your characters with my parents or my grandparents. It was just interesting.
And I think letters, too, allow us to do that a little more easily. I mean, you can read a history book about World War II, World War I, and you can get the facts and the maps and the timelines and all of those official details. But letters, and especially family letters, sort of fill in the unsaid things. They fill in what people were thinking, what they were actually doing, what they were fearing, what they were dreaming about. And I like that I was able to bring those out very easily in an epistolary novel.
In the book, probably in the movie, Mrs. Miniver.
If
you remember that.
Yes.
That was set in Britain about the time of Dunkirk.
Yes.
And one of the main characters takes his boat over and helps bring people back. Yeah. But again, that there's a certain value to understanding the shaking of the world that your parents or your grandparents were experiencing when everything was turned upside down and life was not ever going to be the same, and you knew it, but you didn't know what was going to happen. You know, and when you're used to have things going along in a nice linear progression with only minor deviations, it's valuable. It's valuable to go back and take a look at in the vehicle that you've used, which I like very much, is this epistolary concept, to look at the how it happened in World War I and II, the shaking up, but how it's actually happening now and how people, because we're in a very turbulent time in our national lives. And it's people will, two generations from now, look back and say, I wonder what Aunt Jessica was thinking at that time.
And I think there's a tendency of each generation to think that their problems are unique and the ways that they're approaching their problems are unique without, maybe that's one reason I like history, is you could see the mistakes made before. People have tried the same things and they protested the same things and they've had disagreements over the same things.
Yes, and they had hatreds. They had real hatreds.
Absolutely.
The hatreds that were engaged in the United States and the interventionist versus the isolationist groups were far more vicious in language than even what we go through right now. Unfortunately, this is terrible to say, I have to come to the end of this show. It's been a delight talking to you about a wonderful book, Letters from Sky, and it's published by Ballantine, and you can find it in all the finest bookstores in the entire world. And I am not promoting the book. I am simply saying I enjoyed it very much. So thank you very much for joining me today, and with respect.
Thank you for having me.
The name of our program is With Respect. We're on every Sunday morning at 11 and every Thursday morning at 10. And until next time, keep remembering, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.